last week.
Sounds good.
And
sorry,
forgot to do that completely. What was it? Oh, we got all the last slide of the algorithms chapter. That's what it was, which is about vectors. And we were talking about the runtime complexity of the various vector operations. And the one that, and we talked about all of these bullets except this one. And I said we were going to postpone discussion of that one. So let me just remind you of what this is all about. That we're talking about the vector. The, our particular FSU library calls it a T-vector. T-vector complexity requirements. Now, first of all, let me back up for a minute. Notice I call them requirements. What the new ground broken by C++ is, actually this might have come in with Ada, but it's definitely been pushed a lot more with C++, is that, for example, in the standard template library, what you do is you specify the behavior of the library element, like say vector, in terms of what is the public interface of vector, what kind of iterators does it have, that sort of thing. And you specify the runtime complexity, the worst case runtime complexity for the operations. But then you don't specify how people have to implement it. Of course, you don't want to specify it where nobody can figure out how to implement it. You should have an example in mind to prove that you can meet the specifications. But, so that's what I mean by complex requirements. These would be things that you assert that must be true about the T-vector implementation. And then when we provide the implementation, it's up to us to prove that they're true. So what you find is that in the ISO standard for C++, there are specifications for the runtimes of operations on the various methods for the container classes, for example, and also for the, I'm not sure about generic algorithms. Algorithms are usually, the process is assumed by the name of the algorithm, so I guess maybe they're not specified. But we're supposed to use the process that the algorithm calls for. But, so, when the question is, what about vector? Well, remember, in a vector, we got pushback and popback. That's the way we can put one extra element onto the back of a vector and take an element off the back of the vector. And remember, the underlying implementation mechanism we have is we have a footprint that's an allocated array of type T, and we call that the size of that is called the capacity of the vector, the size of that footprint array. We also have a second sizing kind of parameter for vector called size, and that can vary from zero up to capacity. So there's a notion of size of the vector that's as independent as it can be from the footprint. So you have this fixed footprint, and you can grow a vector in that footprint from zero out to as big as the footprint is and let it go back down. And while you're growing and shrinking in that footprint, you don't have to do any memory allocation, which makes stuff work fast. Right? Basically, you get the same speed you would have if you just had a raw array down there that you were accessing. We're accessing it indirectly, but once the code is compiled, of course, everything gets low level, and you're really down there in that array when you get up to the object code. So, for example, popback just merely decrements the size parameter. That's all it's got to do. And so popback clearly is a constant time operation. The bracket operator, all it does is access the bracket operator for the low-level array and return that element, so that's a constant time operation. All these informationals like front and back, front returns the size, the item at index size minus one. I'm sorry. Back returns the item at index size minus one. Front returns the item at index zero. You know, those are kind of transparently constant time operations. And then there are others that are transparently sort of the size, either the size or capacity depending. And it's a little surprising at first that things like set capacity, which basically doesn't really have a loop in it, but it does have a call to operator new, and so you wonder why that has runtime on the order of n instead of constant. And the reason is that a call to operator new with the bracket version of operator new is an O of n operation itself, because what that does is allocate a block of memory, but then go back and call the type T constructor for every T footprint in that block. And so that's a loop that gets done below the level of your program. So everything up there is fairly straightforward and easy to understand, except for that bullet that talks about the amortized runtime complexity of the pushback operation. And remember, in pushback, what you have to do is expand the size of the vector by one. If you are, and most of the time, you know, when size parameter is less than the capacity parameter, most of the time, that's true. And when you push back, all you got to do is increment the size and put the new element in the vacated location or the made available location in that footprint. But occasionally, you have a call to push back that will be the case when the size is already equal to capacity, and if you push back, then you have to increase the capacity of the vector. And that is what I've referred to as taking a timeout. And there's a lengthy intricate process that has to happen there. First thing you got to do is get a new footprint that's bigger. The second thing you've got to do is copy the data from the old that you already have from the old footprint to the new footprint, because there's no guarantee they'll be related to each other where they are. Then you have to release the memory in the old footprint, delete. And that would be then the end of your timeout. Well, I guess you set the capacity equal to the size of the new footprint. Then that's the end of your timeout. Now you can go back, you have now back in the case where size is less than capacity, and you just increment size and put the element in there. Right? Everybody remember that? Sound familiar? So the question is, what is the runtime of this operation? Clearly, most of the time it's constant, right? Most of the time all you're doing is incrementing size and copying a new element in the made available location. But every now and then you have the timeout, which is quite costly. So and it's a little hard to predict. Unless the client is really knowledgeable and careful about keeping track of things, the client might not even be able to predict when this timeout will occur. And by the way, one thing that is available to the client is an ability to set the capacity in advance to something big. If they anticipate pushbacking a lot of stuff, they can set the capacity to be big, and then this timeout will occur. But in any case, the question becomes then, well, what is the average cost of a pushback operation? And I think it's clear by now that we can't insist that the cost of the pushback operation be constant. That's not going to be possible. But we can ask that its average cost be constant, kind of the next best thing. And that is possible. And the question, so what the last thing I wanted to talk about was proof that in our implementation, average cost of a pushback operation is constant. It's asymptotically constant. And this is, there are arguments like this in your next class at COP 4531. These are typical arguments in analysis of algorithms, and this is your first introduction to this kind of argument, so I want to go over it in some detail with you. So that's in the narrative. That in that narrative we have this assertion, T vector pushback has amortized runtime complexity less than or equal to 0 or 1, meaning constant. And amortized complexity of a function is really the average cost of n calls. And so what you do is you take, for example, f of 1 plus f of 2 plus f of n, divide by the number of calls you made, call that a of n. That's the average cost. And what we want to show is when F is the complexity, when F is the cost of the pushback, that A then A can be shown to be asymptotically constant. Now, let's look at the pushback. There is the way that's implemented. If size is bigger than capacity, that's when we take the timeout. And after the timeout, we always do these things. Note that the timeout happens. If the timeout doesn't happen, it means size is less than capacity, and so this is a legitimate thing to do, and that's what you do. So let C as a function of n denote the runtime of the portion of this code that's always executed, namely that. The header of the if statement, and then all of the three statements that follow it. Okay? And let's let D be the cost of the body of the if statement. Which is that. C of n is independent of size. C of n is the cost of this. It's independent of size. That's just like 1, 2, 3, 4 lines of code that isn't a loop, doesn't depend on the size of the vector, right? So that has to, so C of n is constant. It's not dependent on n. So C of n, here's, I'm trying to find where I wrote that. C of n is really a constant. I'm just going to call it C. The other thing I want you to observe is that D of n is zero most of the time, because most of the time you don't go through the body of that if state. Most of the time you circumvent it. The only time you go through the body of the if statement is when size equals capacity. So D of n equals n, and when size equals capacity, your principal thing you do there is this is the case where n equals 1. But in general, what you do is you call, it's a call to set capacity with the parameter set in there doubling the size of the capacity. And the if not just says if somehow the memory allocation fails, then we're going to return a 0. But you expect the memory allocation to happen, and so the capacity will be changed to 2 times the old capacity. And so C of n, so I'm sorry, so D of n is n, the number of elements currently in the vector, because size and capacity are the same. When you have the timeout, and 0 otherwise. So what I want to do then is make some observations. Suppose you start with an empty vector, and we'll do n pushback calls. Then when does this happen? When does size bigger than capacity happen? It happens every time you reach a power of 2, because we're doubling each time. So we start off with size 0. The first pushback gives you size 1. The second pushback doubles it to 2. And then the third one and the fourth one are just a low cost. And then the fifth one has to double 4 to 8. 5, 6, and 7 are low cost. Then the eighth one doubles it to 16, and so on. Okay? So D of n is n when n is a power of 2, and 0 otherwise. So that, now don't forget, our total cost is C, this constant, plus D of n. So now let's compute the average. We'll see what happens. The average is f of 1 plus through f of n divided by n. That's c plus d of 1 plus c plus d of 2 da-da-da through n divided by n. And note that you can, there's n c's in there, and that n, those n c's are divided by n, so you can pull a c out of that whole thing. And that just leaves you with d of 1 plus d of 2 plus d of 3 divided by n. All added to C. It's just arithmetic. Now let's start plugging in. That's C plus 1, because 1 is a power of 2. Right? It's the 0 power of 2. Plus 2, because 2 is a power of 2. Plus 0, because 3 is not a power of 2. Plus 4, which is a power of 2. 0, 0, 0, because 5, 6, and 7 are not powers of 2. 8, because that's a power of 2. So on. Those, the 1, the 2, the 4, and the 8, and the 16, and the 32, the zeros in between, all represent the timeouts taken when you have to double the capacity. Everybody following this? So if you look at what you got here, you don't have, the zeros aren't adding anything to the total, right? And what you have here is the sum of the power of 2 all the way out to the power k. If we're assuming we, you know, let's go all the way out to n equals some power of 2, the last doubling. And So that's n, 2 to some power, and that's n again, the thing you're dividing by. So you have the sum of the powers of 2 out to k divided by 2 to the k, the last one of those. And here's where the magic occurs, because the sum of the powers of 2 is just, there's a formula from discrete math that'll tell you that's 2 to the k plus 1 minus 1. We have 2 to the k plus 1 minus 1 divided by 2 to the k. Well, I can add a 1 to this and put a less than here. 2 to the k plus 1 minus 1 plus 1 is just 2 to the k plus 1, right? So by putting a less than sign here, I can say that that's less than c plus 2 to the k plus 1 divided by 2 to the k. But 2 to the k plus 1 divided by 2 to the k is just 2. And suddenly the dependence on the size disappears. So a of n is less than c plus 2. Remember what a of n was. It's the average cost of the pushbacks. Starting with an empty vector and going all the way out to some n equal 2 to the k. And the average cost is c plus 2. C is the cost of those 2 or 3 lines of code that you always execute. 2 is an upper bound on the cost, on the average cost of all those timeouts, which is truly astonishing. But there you have it. The real reason this is true is because there's so many of these zeros in there. When you get out to big numbers, you have a power of 2, like say, you know, you get the 256. That's a power of 2, but then for the next 255 numbers of 0, until you get the 512, and then you have the 512. And then the next 512 numbers of 0, until you get to 1024. So the fact that you have so many zeros in the numerator is what's making this thing, this average, be smaller. So we have a of n is actually less than c plus 2, and that certainly is sufficient to prove that it's asymptotic. The complexity is constant. We've got it literally bounded by that constant. Question. When y'all are down at your keyboards, are you like reading news groups, or are you doing paying attention to the lecture?
Some of us.
I find that a little distracting, but I'm not going to complain about it. As long as you don't abuse it.
You should sneak in a little security thing. They have little squares of every monitor.
Gosh, I can probably do that here. But back when I was teaching this in a large lecture class, I used to refuse to have a classroom where everybody had monitors, because there'd be so much clicking and surfing. You know, it's like giving everybody a newspaper when they come into the door. Alright, so let's go back to where we were. Here is our calendar. We have done the algorithms chapter. Even last week, the portion of the algorithm chapter we did covered the lower bound algorithm version of binary search, which is the last piece of the puzzle you needed for project one. Did we talk about project one yet in class?
Other than going through the notes, discussion on it here.
So, let me talk about it a little bit. This project is called Password Server. It actually looks sort of familiar to those of you who took 3330 in the fall, because I had a project called Password Client, I believe. And what you were supposed to do there is develop a password client for a password server object, which I gave you as object. Now the secret is out. That object code came from Password Server, which I had. And now what I'm asking you to do is write the server side of that system. So whether you recall it or not, a password server presents a public interface, and it's basically designed to be used to authenticate users in a system. The password server does no communication with users at all. The password server is a silent server. It presents a public interface. It has a constructor, which I'll come back to in a moment, but once it's up and running, it has methods available, which are check password, change password, delete user, and create user. Basically, four public methods. And then it has, I guess, yeah, that's all. And then it has a destructor. The check password receives two parameters. It receives, and they're both C strings. The check password takes a const char star, which is a user ID, and it takes a non-const char star, which is a password. What it's supposed to do is return a 1 if that user is authenticated by the password, and a 0 if the user is not authenticated. Period. So its only communication is a return value by the method, 1 or 0. That is intended to be made available to any terminal application in the system. The user's login. Facilitate user login processing. So the particular terminal application that allows the user to log in would be using this server, would be communicating with this server, or one of the server objects. Now, so there are security issues here that we'll come back to in a minute, but let's talk about the functionality issues. So, that particular operation, check password, take, for example, a computer science department. There's 500, maybe 1,000 users, and a lot of those users log in many times a day. So there's many calls to the check password utility. And furthermore, users expect a more or less instant answer so they can get logged in. They don't like to wait. So this, and you know, it wastes their time to make them wait. So you don't want to make a user wait for that. Human time is the most precious thing in computing. Don't forget that. Machine time is not as precious as human time. In most situations. There's some exceptions to that, like in a real-time controller of a vehicle, an autonomous vehicle. In needs to pay real careful attention to time. But in most circumstances, particularly a desktop or general computing environment, human time is precious. Anyway, so you want this check password thing to be fast. And what we're going to specify is that it must run in time theta of log n, where n is the number of users. Or, if you like, n is the number of users. Now, that tells you that if you look at the tools you have available, there's only one that's going to produce that kind of runtime, and that's your binary search algorithms. But it doesn't, the system group that uses the password server doesn't need to know that. All they need to know is it's fast. Now, the other three operations, change password, create new user, and delete user. Let's talk about those. Well, change password is allowed to be a slower operation, and users actually are used to that taking a little bit of time. And often there's a bunch of file writing and stuff that goes on with that anyway. And so once you have to access an external file to rewrite it, the cost of the internal computation is trivial compared to the cost of the time required for that file access anyway. And so it's sort of an irrelevancy whether that takes log n time or n or O of n time. So disk access time is much more, it's much greater than computing time. So, and then the other two, the delete user and create user, are really processes that often are accessible only by a system administrator or through processes specifically designed for those purposes, like the one we have for automate. You can log in and create an account. And again, for creating a new user, there's all kinds of file access involved with that to authenticate that this new user is somehow legitimately entitled an account, for example. So this is destined to be a slow operation because of all the file access, data access. So trying to speed up the internal computation to create user is it's not going to be worth the effort because it's already only using a hundredth or a thousandth of the time that the whole process takes anyway. So if only a thousandth of the time is spent in the internal computing, you speed that up, you're not going to notice it, right? So the create user and delete user, the internal processing of that is also allowed the linear time, the O of N, theta of N. Let's talk about how this system interacts with files. When the system starts up, it's got to read password signature data from the file. And when the system shuts down, it's got to write its password signature data to an output file, a different file. Also, whenever the system's data is changed, for example, when a user changes their password or when a new user is created, a new file has to be written as soon as possible. I mean, the output file for that server has to be rewritten as soon as possible to update the data. Okay. So the way something like this might work is you've got different password server objects operating on as close as possible to the users. When a user changes their password, that changes the internal data of that server, but it has to then propagate out to other servers so that they can notice that there's been a new user added. Anyway, so for change password, create user, and delete user, in all three of those cases, the output file is rewritten. Of course, for check password, no data has changed, so there's no need to rewrite a file. Okay, let's talk about, I used the word signature, let's talk about how the security aspects work. And this is all as realistic as is, can be reasonably made, given the fact that we're writing a standalone system. The way security works is you have a hash function, which is used to create a signature, which will be a number. The algorithm for this hash function is a known entity. The password files store the signatures along with the user IDs. And these are, it's assumed that these are accessible publicly. Now, sometimes they're not really publicly accessible, but the assumption that they are has to be there because you don't rely on keeping one file secret. That can't be the way you protect all user accounts. That's like a single point of failure to blow up the whole world. So you assume that's a public file. But your security comes from the intractability of reversing from signature to password, from signature to the thing that created the signature value. In other words, reversing the hash function. And we've already talked about hash functions in that context. They're mathematically impossible to reverse, and I mean in a formula sense. And they are intractable to guess. So their enigma factor is high, basically. Their enigma attribute is high. So what you store in this password, so what is the signature of a user and their password? What you do is you take the username and the password, create a longer string out of those two entities, and that's what you hash to get a signature. Now the reason you do that is so that if two people accidentally chose the same password, which can happen because, often people choose terrible passwords. That's why they have pass. That's why they make up rules, because people choose easy to guess passwords. It might be the brand of car they drive. Well, how many people have been driving Fords, right? So, if two people happen to choose the same password, don't want their signatures to be the same. Because let's say you chose Ford and I chose Ford for a password. So if we just hash that into the password file, doesn't really contain password, but into this file, and it's a public file, then I could look in there and see, aha, you have the same hash value that I do. So that means I can use my password to get in your account. Now you might even, the awful thing is, you might even have a different password that just happened to have the same signature value as my password. Remember that will occur. You will get collisions from my hash function. Now the chances of that happening are remote, but it could happen. And again, you wouldn't want me noticing that. My password would work in your account just as well as yours in that case. Even though it's not your password, they both produce the same hash value, and that's what you use to check for. So what you do is you concatenate your name with your password, my name with my password. That will, even if we had the same password, because we have different user IDs, that will give us different signatures. So the same password would get different signatures. And let's just say for a moment that if under that system, I noticed that you and I had the same signature. Could I guess your password? No way. It wouldn't help me at all. Because there's no reason to think that your password would be anything like my password, because my signature came from the locker concatenated with Ford, and yours came from your last name concatenated with who knows what, Chevrolet. I mean, it would be impossible to guess. And it just happened to be a collision. But that would be a way to keep accidental collision points in the hash function from opening a security hole for me to get into your account. So that's the whole deal. And then the second deal is the password in clear text is a dangerous thing to have around. You want to have it move in the narrowest possible domain. If it has to go on a network, you want it to be a secure network. And you want to get rid of it as soon as possible after you finish using it. You absolutely do not write it to disk ever, even temporarily. And you don't like to leave it lying around in memory. So there's usually a part of check password or any of these before authentication, any of the authentication step that occurs in each one of these operations. As soon as the hash value of the password and the user ID is computed, you no longer need the actual password anymore because you've computed the hash value. To work with that, what you do is you write over the password with something that just obliterates it. Otherwise, it'll sit around in memory for knows how long, because it's just memory. So once it's deallocated, somebody else might get it and look at it. So that's the reason, that's the subtle reason why in these functions the user ID is passed in as a const charstar, but the password is passed in as a charstar, which is intentionally allowing the password server to obliterate that string that it doesn't own. It's just getting a pointer to letting that obliterate that string as soon as it feels like it, where it's sitting. But notice that we're passing only a pointer to the password, not the password into that thing. And it'll be read from that location and then obliterated as soon as that read is over to minimize the time that the password is sitting around. Just want to make it as hard as possible for people to accidentally discover other people's passwords.
And where the pointer helps you know back where to go right over.
Repeat the question.
And where the pointer helps you know where to go back to make that point right over the password.
Right. So you can write over it. See, normally if you pass a pointer in, you have to be aware that that's somebody else's space. It's the client's space. The client is giving you access to their data, the space that they own with that pointer. If you pass it as a const pointer, that's saying, here's my data, but I won't allow you to change it, don't want to allow you to mess with it. If you pass it as a non-const pointer, that's specifically allowing you to use that pointer and go back and change the data that it points to. So now let's talk about the constructor. So what the constructor's got to do, remember the deal is you got two files. You got an input file name and an output file name. These are both constructor parameters. And the third constructor parameter is just a maximum number of users that you, the system administrator, is going to allow. That'll be a policy decision. The constructor for a password server will first allocate a, first create a vector. It'll have a private vector where it's going to store password, comma, signature data. Okay. The first thing it's got to do is make that vector be the right size. It'll make it the size of the max number of users. And it can do that with an initialization statement before it gets into the body of the constructor. So the constructor will, the initialization thing will be to create two string objects that hold the names of the two files. Those will be string objects owned by the password server. So they'll, and the third thing it'll do is instantiate that the vector where you're going to store stuff to be the size max users. What that'll guarantee is that you don't ever have to resize that vector, I mean recapacity that vector. You're going to make it biggest as it's allowed to be the first time you instantiate it before you read any data. See, that's another problem. If you made the vector smaller than that and then maybe allowed it to grow later, normally that would not be a bad thing, but in this particular application, that's a security leak, because when you recapacity a vector, nothing in that, all you do is give that memory back. You're not giving it back. You don't, there's nothing that obliterates the contents of that memory. So it's still got the content that it had when you gave it back. So that would be parking the password. Wait a minute, except, I'm sorry. I'll take all that back. I'll take all that back, because that vector doesn't contain critical information. That doesn't contain information you have to keep secret. The vector only contains information that's in the password file, which is a signature. So forget what I said. But nevertheless, there's good reason, there's reliability reasons for going ahead and making the vector as big as possible. Because remember that when you recapacity a vector, you're making a implicitly down under that all somewhere is a call to new, operator new, and that is a request, not a demand, to the operating system. That can fail. And that would be a point of failure for your password service that's beyond the control of the password server, which would make it potentially crash. So just to make sure that it's as reliable as possible, you go ahead and allocate all the space you can use when you instantiate the password server for the first time, and then during normal operation, it won't have to make any calls to operator new, and it'll be in control of its own life, basically. So really, this password server can be written with a raw array. Just go ahead and allocate the big array. And I'm asking you to use a vector because one of these vectors. So anyway, so the password server constructor will first store the two passed in names, copies of them, and string objects. Then it will instantiate the vector to be the size of the maximum number of users. Then it'll go into the body. And in the body, it has to open the input file, read the data from the input file by first reading the number. There's a number in the input file that tells you how many current users that you do have. You read that number, and then you go into a for loop and you read user ID data, user ID signature through the end of that for loop. But you're guaranteed this file is correct because it's been created by the server. It's not created by humans. But it knows what's in the file, right? And so you don't have to worry about syntax of the file and all this stuff. And you read all that stuff in and you put it in the vector. And then that's the end of the construction process. Then you've got the user, comma, signature data in the vector that's owned by the password server, and that's where it does its lookups. In particular, because it's a vector stored internally, it's in memory. You can use binary search on that vector, and that's how you check password gets fast. The right. So, of course, so you've got to use your lookup will always be your lower bound binary search algorithm. That's going to guarantee that check password is fast. Everything else is going to be slow, not because it's slow to look things up in that vector, because there's file operations associated with every one of them. Those are just it. You know, unimaginably slower than computer operations, so memory operations. So they're hopelessly slow anyway. So that's pretty much it. And then when the destructor has to write the contents of the vector to the output file, that's different from the input file. Also, remember I also mentioned that three out of four of the public methods also have to rewrite, have to write to the output file. So remember, every one of these has to open the output file, write to it, and then close it. I recommend, therefore, that you put a function, let's say in the private portion, called write password file or something, that can be called by all four of these things, right? The three public methods and the destructor can all call this one function instead of having to keep the code. But in that write password file function or method, again, you got to be sure that you open the file, write the file, and then close the file. Because if you forget to close it, then the next time you try to open it, it'll be locked and you won't be able to get to it. Will be owned by a previous call you made out of the same server, basically. So, what else to talk about? Okay, there's the problem. Okay, let's talk about the vector. I've been saying put the password, comma, signature data in a vector. Well, vectors have a single type parameter. Vector has an element of type 2. So how are we putting two items in one element? The very common problem happens all the time, and what you have to do is invent some convenient notion of a pair, call that a type, make that into a type that you can then use for the vector element. In fact, in the standard template library, there is a thing called pair. In a situation like this, and in almost all other situations, it's actually better to invent your own notion of pair than to use that generic one, because you want to be in control of all the properties. You want to know, for example, how you know when two pairs are equal. How do you know when one pair is less than another pair? What is the output operator overloaded to this pair going to do? How do you assign one pair to another? And these are all, the answers to these questions can vary slightly from application to application, and often it's better, therefore, just to invent your own, because they're really easy to do. You just have to do it. And in this case, you just have to remember that the pair is going to have two data items. One is going to be a string, which is the user ID, and the second one is going to be an unsigned integer, I guess an unsigned long. I can't remember whichever it is, an unsigned int maybe, that is the signature. And that will be the data of the pair. And you can make it public, you know, so everything in this class, this power class, can be public, which means you don't have to write, do all the sets and guess. It would make it more tedious to create this object, to create this class. You just get to the data by just the dot notation. So that's not the issue. The issue is how will they be assigned if you need to assign them? How will they be compared to the less than operator? Things like that. And the answer in all of those, the answer of the comparisons, all the logical, you know, the equals, not equals, less than, what you will do is say that pair 1 is less than pair 2 means in the implementation that the pair 1 dot user ID is less than pair 2 dot user ID. I completely ignore the signature. Ditto for equals, for double equals, you know, the logical operator. They'll be equal if they have equal user IDs, period. And what this does is allow you to maintain sorted order in this vector. And sorted order for the vector will mean sorted by user ID, ignoring user signature. Once you have a vector that's in sorted order, then you can do binary search on that vector. Particularly, you can do the lower bound algorithm. That's will be your principal thing that you use to find the location where a user should be in that vector. And therefore, I recommend you have a private method, make up a name for it, index, lower bound, whatever you want to call it, that does that search for you, implements the binary search algorithm. Probably also a good idea to have a private variable that stores the result of that search, because often in these, in implementing these public methods, you have to know that index twice while you're implementing the method. You don't want to have to do the search twice, even though it's a fast search. The point in doing it twice when you can just remember it. So the simplest thing is just have a class variable called index or something that is the result of a search. And that also gives you something you can dump out if you're trying to debug your application. Know the result of the last search that you did, right? So, anything else? I think that's pretty much it. Once you've got your binary search function, your lower bound function that supplies the index, that's kind of the heavy lifting that all the public methods need. And for example, check password would, of course, first do a search, get an index. Then the first thing to check, then it would check whether the user ID in the vector is the same as the user ID that's been passed in. Well, actually, the first thing it would do is check to be sure that the index is less than the size of the current size of the vector, or the current number of users. I'm sorry, whichever current number of users. Now, that current number of users you can either store as a separate number and let the size of the vector the same as the capacity of the vector, or you can let the size of the vector vary and always be the number. I'm saying size, not capacity. Capacity was set from the very beginning to be the maximum number of users. You can handle that. You've got to figure out your internal logic, how you want this to work. But in any case, you have a certain range that you need to search on, and remember that for the lower bound algorithm, the first index past the range is a legitimate return value. So if you do a search and that index gets returned, that tells you automatically that you didn't find that user in the database. So anyway, back to check password. First thing you do is check to make sure that the index is in the range. Then you check to see that the user ID that's stored is equal to the user ID handed in. Because remember, the lower bound only returns the index where it should be. It doesn't guarantee you that it's actually found it. So now you know, so if that checks out, then you know you found the user. And the third thing you do is check to see if the user, the third thing you do is just hash the user and signature, the user ID plus signature string to get a signature and compare that with the signature that's stored. And if those are equal, then you return a 1. And in all other circumstances, you return 0. So the logic would be something like this. If index is less than the number of users, if user bracket index dot UID is equal to UID that got passed in, if, now at the third level of ifs now, if user bracket index dot signature equals the signature you just computed, return a 1. So that's 3 deep in the ifs. And then come all the way back out of that and return a 0 for all of the circumstances. If it fails any one of those tests, it's failed. And you keep your logic straight by using braces there. These are single lines. It's certain. It's easy to get. It's easy to have that get misinterpreted by either you or the compiler if you're not careful. Use braces and it won't happen. And similar logic for all the others. Always check all of the authentication steps before you do anything. So, for example, change password. If index is less than the number of users inside of a brace, if the user at user bracket index close bracket dot UID equals the UID that got passed in, another brace. If you got to go through the hashing and the password thing. If it passes all those tests, then take the new signature, the new password, create a new signature, replace the old one with the new one, and return 1. But if you failed any one of those steps, you just return a 0 and do nothing. So finally, another final piece of advice is probably helpful to write another private method that does this hashing thing for you, because it's sort of complicated, right? You got to take the user ID and the user password, concatenate them, and compute the hash value for that. And that could be, you've got to do that in all the public methods, so why not have a private function that does it, do it there, and have that be called by the public methods. Security advice would be call that early. Security advice would be inside of that function we were talking about just now that creates the hash, that would be the place where as soon as you've made the concatenated string and computed the hash value from it, you obliterate the passed in password. So the hash function, the hash, I'm sorry, the, if thing that computes the signature could do the obliteration part. If you call that early, that gets the user to clear text, use a password out of memory as soon as possible. So you can really call that before you start, if you wanted to, before you started even all the if statements in your public method. Obviously, I'm not requiring that. These are things to think about. If you're really writing a password server to be part of a system. So the private functions that you might that'll help you, it seems to me, are one called write password file, one called compute signature or something, and one called locate index or something. Names, obviously, choose what you want. Do things that make sense. The write password file would be called by the destructor in 3 out of 4 of the public methods. The locate function would be called by all 4 of the public methods. The compute hash or compute signature function would be called by all 4 of the public methods. So, any questions? Back to our calendar. We are officially finished with the material I stated as goals for week 5. That doesn't mean we're going to have class finished early, though, because I like to get a jump on new stuff. What I'd like you to do is look at week 6. Well, we're going to talk about lists. Those are going to be doubly linked list application. That's going to list. It's going to be a templated container class on a par with Vector. You also have a project too, and you notice I'm assigning that the same week we talk about lists. And the reason for that is that it's a project that involves linked structures. So I guess you figured out by now that project gets assigned at about the place where you've covered most of the things you need to know for the project. The due date is listed over here in the right-hand column. So anyway, that ring buffer project we will talk about after we talk about Chapter 8. So the plan will be, I'm going to talk about Chapter 8 today. Then I'm going to talk about the ring buffer project next week. That's going to be tough on you because let me think. What is the date? The due date for project 1 is the 13th. That's not this weekend, is it? Next weekend. So this is going to be tough on you because you got to listen about Project 2 4 days before Project 1 is due. But, you know, that's the real computing life is like that. So I don't feel bad about that, but you got to get used to that. All right? It's going to be tough to concentrate on this ring buffer project discussion if you're going crazy trying to find bugs in your password server. So I'd like for you to please get that thing, get the password server thing drafted out and kind of working before next Thursday. What that'll do is give you a few days to really make it spiffy before you finally have to turn it in. Typically, if you finish a project early and sit on it for a couple of days, you inevitably think of ways to make it better, more bulletproof, and more proud of it, basically. And you gonna, you'll find you're putting enough work into these things that you're going to like them by the time you finish. You're going to like the work, the product of your work.
You might not like
the work you have to do them, but once you've done them, you will be proud of the job. So give yourself some time.
You'll be amazed if you finish that year out.
Give yourself some time to make it spiffed up a little bit.
That's what I think.
Once I know it works, great. It's yours now. Where's that submit script?
It works.
But this project, too, is a lot of fun. You're going to enjoy it. Project 3, the Rat Pack, is another one that's a classic in data structures that you will enjoy a lot. And will be hard. Another, so you got the distraction of Project 2 being assigned before the midterm, but due after the midterm. Did I get that right? Yes. Project 3, the Rat Pack, is assigned before the midterm. It is due after the midterm and after spring break.
What's the late penalty?
Let's get something fun to do over spring break.
Well, you always wanted to have something to do spring break. Like,
what's been around here to do for spring break?
Yeah.
Hide from all the spring breakers from Pennsylvania or wherever they come from.
I'm glad I got my laptop because then I can do it while we're on the road.
So that's the plan. Let's take a little leg stretch here today, and we'll come back and start talking about lists, and then we'll go to the lab later, which is of course where we are. But I mean,
we'll go to the lab.
Switch into lab mode later, and talk about issues that you might be having.
We complain enough. They finally gave us a lab.